simply magically uninhibited. The only person in our class, or any class I'd ever taken for that matter, whom I actually look forward to watching perform. The rest of us were toying with chemistry sets. He was lighting the lab on fire. After Shelton dismissed us, I made a beeline for the guy. He was getting his stuff together, putting on his jacket, the adrenaline still draining from his face. I knew he probably didn't feel like talking, so I got right to it. You want to do a scene together? He looked at me. His eyes narrowed, his mouth partly open. I couldn't tell if he was annoyed or offended or pleased. You and me? He asked. Yeah. Why you ask me? He asked, irritably. The directness of this question caught me off guard. I just thought that since you don't have a partner anymore... He stopped me and reached into his jacket pocket and pulled out a business card for something called Street Fashions USA. Well, he said, pick a play and call me on this number. Only this number. We see. I think about it. On the card below, the Street Fashions logo, Thomas P. Wiseau. Call me Tommy, he said as I read the card. Not Thomas. His was an odd last name. It sounded sort of like Wiseau, the French word for bird. But French names don't begin with W. I'm Greg, by the way. To this he said nothing. Then he walked away. I called him a day later. Again, he sounded irritated and asked me what play I'd picked out. I couldn't find one, I said. Walnut Creek doesn't have too many places where you can buy plays. Ah, he said. You live in suburban area. Come to city, San Francisco, and we pick one. I see you Thursday at 3 p.m. in front of Bank of America, Vanessa and the Market. Don't be late, okay? I didn't know what to expect, or if he'd even show up. So I brought my soccer ball along, thinking that if things went haywire, I could at least redeem the day by playing some pickup soccer in Golden Gate Park. Tommy turned up 20 minutes late, driving a shiny new white 1998 Mercedes-Benz C280. I hadn't been expecting that. What had I been expecting? A hearse? Maybe a decommissioned ice cream truck? I would have sooner expected him to land a crop-dusting biplane on Market Street than pull up alongside the Bank of America curb in an eye-searingly spotless white Benz. I popped the door and climbed inside. Nice car, I said unnecessarily. Tommy was staring at me through his sunglasses. Don't talk about me, okay? Don't talk about you? In the class. Don't talk about me in the class. Oh, okay. I had no idea what he was talking about. What do you mean? We don't talk about the car, what I drive, etc., okay? You mean now, or we talk now, but in class we don't talk. He took note of my soccer ball, and his mouth did something quick and ghoulish, which was, I think, intended to resemble a smile. So, you have ball, he pointed at me. I see the scheme you have in your forehead. Scheme? I don't have a scheme, I said, but he'd become serious again. So, you bring play? I didn't say anything for a moment, not quite getting his meaning. Ball, scheme, play. It was a little confusing, especially with his accent and tense adrift syntax. Play, he said again, more insistently, for scene. Oh, no, I thought you said, so we go get play and we plan scene together, okay? Okay. I said. What had I gotten myself into? I'd never been that interested in stage acting. I knew a few household name playwrights, but beyond that, my experience with theater was pathetically minimal. Compared to Tommy, though, I was a PhD candidate specializing in contemporary American drama. At the bookstore, I suggested a couple of big name playwrights who wrote good male parts for us to take a look at, Mamet, Simon, but Tommy said no. He suggested the Glass Menagerie, claiming Tennessee Williams was his favorite playwright. But I suspect that was because he knew Williams had written A Streetcar Named Desire, a movie he obviously loved. The Glass Menagerie had enough scenes in which the play's two male characters interacted without others present, but I wanted to see Tommy do something more modern. "Let's try something different," I said, "more contemporary." I handed Tommy some plays that had been written within the last decade. I'd annoyed him, it seemed. He didn't accept the plays and removed his sunglasses. "Why do you have donut hairstyle?" I looked back at him confused. "What?" "You have the donut hairstyle." Whatever he meant, I didn't respond. "Here," Tommy said, holding a play out to me. "I like this. We do this one." It was an Australian play. I'd never heard of it before and haven't heard of it since. It was about dudes hanging out and talking about women and music and life and occasionally threatening to beat each other up. Before I could say yes or no, Tommy was heading to the register with the store's only two copies. Back in the car, Tommy seemed aloof and standoffish. "I have to eat now," he said, "because I get cranky a little bit when I don't eat." He rolled his eyes. "I pay, don't worry." His tone was so brusque and his spontaneous offer to pay so passive-aggressively presumptuous that I just nodded sullenly. Why had I thought having Tommy as my scene partner would be fun? Tommy noticed my sullenness. "Hey, Greg." He was tapping this transformery robot thing he'd affixed to his dashboard. It looked a little bit like an armored crab, the cheap, Happy Mealish toy that a boy might stick to his bedroom windowsill. "Be careful, Greg," Tommy said as he bobbled his dashboard toy. "Be careful or monster will get you." I think he was trying to break the ice. But typically you break the ice before venturing out into a frozen lake, not after you've gotten stuck in the middle of it. How old was Tommy anyway? He dressed like he was in his 20s. Some of his mannerisms and affectations did occasionally seem boyish. For example, the robot crab he'd stuck to the dash of his $60,000 car. But there was something about his face and eyes that appeared wrung out. If I'd had to bet, I would have guessed that Tommy was 40-something, at least. Tommy wanted to eat at Pasta Pomodoro on Irving Street, which was in the general area of Golden Gate Park. We sat down and ordered our food. Tommy asked for pesto pasta, minestrone soup, a Caesar salad, and a glass of hot water. After noticing the waitress's surprised face, he said, "I'm demanding, I know. I eat like elephant." Moments after the waitress left us, Tommy whipped out both copies of our chosen play and handed me mine. "All right," he said. "Now we do scene." "Wait," I said, "now?" Tommy was unperturbed. "So what? Yes, we do it now." I looked around. All the tables around us were full. "Shouldn't we eat first?" "What? Are you not dedicated actor? Rehearsal is very important." Tommy was already demonstrating a lot of promise in knowing how to embarrass the shit out of me. I opened up my copy of the play. With a sigh, I asked, "Where do you want to start?" He was on the first page. "We start in the beginning." Tommy wanted to be the character who spoke first, whose name was Jock. These were Jock's first lines. "The noisy friar bird, the featherhead, like my English teacher." Tommy managed to nail his performance on "the," faltered on "noisy," and succumbed to utter bafflement on "friar bird." He asked what a friar bird was. I said I had no idea. We moved on to featherhead. He wanted to know what that was, too. Again, I didn't know, but told him it was probably just a flavor word. Nothing to worry about, let's move on. Amazingly, English teacher also tripped him up. Yes, Tommy had made something less than an ideal choice in going with this play. My character's first line was this, a poet. I said my line and waited for Tommy to read his. He didn't. Greg, he said, you have to raise your voice, okay? It's too low at this time. My voice was low, I wanted to say, because I was in a crowded restaurant. I think it's okay, I said quietly. It's not okay, he said. Your voice is too low. It has to go up. I don't like monotone stuff. I said the line again to avoid further humiliation. Okay, he said. Better for now. We went on a bit more until Tommy came to the line, I've plowed a whole paddock, which he read with all the force and vigor of a Senegalese immigrant on the first day of an ESL class. Again, he looked up at me. Why don't you correct me? You're not helping. He stared at the page. What does this mean? It meant he'd picked the wrong play. When we came to one of the rare moments in which my character actually got to say something that was not a direct response to something his character said, Tommy again told me to raise my voice, like a teacher rapidly losing patience with an unpromising student. We blundered through the whole play like that. The people sitting close to us at first pretended not to be listening, but were soon freely exchanging laughter and eye rolls, none of which Tommy seemed to notice. I sort of admired his obliviousness. It was almost 5 o'clock by the time we got back to Tommy's car. So, he said, I see you have this soccer ball. Yeah, I said. I was thinking I'd go play later. Then let's go play soccer. I looked at his black slacks and long-sleeved shirt. You're sure? I asked. You're not really dressed for soccer. Forget about this stuff. I want to play. I'd been playing at Golden Gate Park's polo fields all summer and suggested we go there. A few minutes later, we pulled up and parked beneath some large eucalyptus trees. There were no summer league games going on at the moment, so it wasn't too crowded. My God, Tommy said, the sun shines like hell today. He went back to the car to plaster sunscreen on himself. His pale face now looked even paler in the light. I noticed irritated red patches on the sides of his face and small bulges at his cheeks. His jaw was his best feature, as big and rugged as that of an old matinee idol. Everything else was off somehow. This park is perfect place for a vampire, Tommy said, looking around happily. I think vampire from Alcatraz live here. I had nothing to say about that. Okay, Tommy said, running ahead. Let's play before I get heart attack. Tommy said not to take it easy on him because he'd played plenty of soccer before. When we got to the polo fields, I fed him a through pass. He bobbled the ball badly when it reached him. Where are you from, anyway? New Orleans, he said. Tommy kicked me the ball. I kicked it back to him. From the look of things, I doubted Tommy had ever dribbled a soccer ball before. He was trying, though. In time, he managed to boot the ball back to me, just as a misty fog started to roll in. The temperature dropped savagely, as though to accommodate Tommy's Undertaker presence. Tommy began making some peculiar woo-woo-woo noises. He was loosening up. When he managed to kick the ball into the goal, he said, "Touchdown!" At some point, I realized that I, too, was having fun. Tommy asked me what I thought of Jean Shelton. I like her, I said, sending the ball over to him. She's tough, but fair. Tommy kicked it back. We argue, as you know. I don't think she liked me, but so what? I say how I feel. Feelings. That's all we have as human beings. You know, I have to work so hard to get to her. What do you mean? I study with her son first, Chris. You don't know him? I didn't know Gene Shelton had a son. No, I said, I don't. He's not so friendly guy. In one class we had big argument and he threw pencil at me. Despite not knowing Shelton's son Chris, I had no trouble believing this. They play the politics, Tommy said. Then, I saw you one time when you come to observe the Gene's class. Really? When was that? A few months ago. You were sitting there like you own the world. Me? Own the world? I live with my parents. I didn't even own a bicycle. I wanted to do performance in front of you, but you left before I could ask. This was bizarre. Why? I think, oh, I want to impress this All-America kid. I can show him good performance. We kicked the ball in silence for a little while. You been to Los Angeles? He asked. A few times. In LA, my God, everyone want to be big star. You go to gym and classes, and all you see are actors, actors. Where do these people go? What happens if they don't make it? Keep in mind, everybody there waiting for their chance. All these pretty boys. You just have to do your best, I said. No, I'm sorry, young man. May I correct you? You have to do more than that. You have to be the best. I'm not sure why, but Tommy's words ran through me like a lance. Maybe that's what I was doing wrong. Trying my best and not even thinking about being my best. I told Tommy how close I'd come to landing a movie part the week before, and how disheartened I felt. He stopped kicking the ball and walked over to me. Then you should be proud of yourself. You need to think positive. Many people never get close to anything. He paused and removed his sunglasses. You can be big actor. In the time since I'd learned I wasn't going to be in Wildflowers, not one person had consoled me. Tommy was the first. So he had a kind side to him after all. Thanks, I said, touched by his sincerity. Tommy had no way of knowing how close I was to quitting acting. His little speech helped. It helped a lot. As we were leaving, Tommy spied some pull-up bars and gymnastic rings at a workout area along the polo field's edge. Watch this, he said. He lifted himself into an iron cross position and held it for several seconds before flipping himself backward while still maintaining his grip on the rings. He didn't touch the ground, or more surprisingly yet, dislocate both shoulders. As a display of upper body strength, it was incredible, but he'd also managed his flip with real grace. Tommy dropped back to the ground, every vein in his neck and forehead engorged from the effort. I asked, were you an Olympic gymnast or something? Tommy, struggling for breath, laughed. You asked too many questions. He grabbed one of the rings and held it out to me. Why don't you try? That's okay, I said. Come on, just try. Don't be chicken. If I try to do what you just did, you'll have to take me to the hospital. No, not hospital. He walked over to me and gave my back a manly swat. Don't be so dramatic, but you good sport overall. When he dropped me off at the Powell BART station, he did this extremely complicated fist bump goodbye bro move. Be cool, he said. We need to rehearse at least 2 or 3 times before the class. Very important. I'm a serious actor. I know, I said. Bye, Tommy. He drove away. I wasn't sure when I'd hear from him, but he called me the next morning, not bothering to introduce himself. I'm sore, he said. We rehearsed again a few days later, this time at Tommy's condo on Guerrero Street. He picked me up at Virgin Records on Market. It was pouring rain and he was late. When I got into the car, he said, We have groovy time playing with your soccer ball, but it's time now to rehearse and do real work. We drove back to his place. Why Tommy didn't tell me his address and have me meet him there, I have no idea. He also didn't know how to use his windshield wipers. He drove leaning forward as close to his windshield as possible and made the sign of the cross after every church we passed. After nearly killing us several times, Tommy descended into his complex's parking garage, which had hardly any cars in it. Every time he did see one, though, no matter how far away it was, Tommy slammed on the brakes. He pulled into a space that had a Bad Era Michael Jackson poster on the storage door in front of it. Once parked, he reached into the back seat for the anti-car theft device known as the club. He hung his club over the steering wheel, but didn't lock it. I asked Tommy if he was going to lock the thing into place. He'd lost the key, it turned out, but the mere appearance of a club, he explained, was enough to deter thieves. Next to his parking spot was another car he owned, a beige early 1980s Trans Am. All of its tires were flat, and it was covered in roughly 5 coats of dust, in which someone, Tommy, had used his finger to draw the Zodiac Killer symbol. This unnerved me greatly until Tommy admitted he had no idea what that symbol meant. At least I now knew that Tommy was probably not going to murder me when we got to his condo. The parking garage elevator to his third floor condo required a key. When Tommy pulled his key ring from his jacket pocket, the mystery of the missing club key more or less solved itself. Tommy's key ring had the diameter of an appetizer plate and was strung with so many keys that he suddenly looked like a medieval jailer. For several seconds, Tommy fumbled to find the elevator key. A few moments later, with a distant rumble, the elevator began to come down, clanking as ominously as I imagined an elevator in an old mental institution would. "I must ask you again," Tommy said, as the elevator doors opened, "that you please don't talk about me. Where I live, for example." "I'm not going to talk about you," I said. "Not even to my cat." Tommy's condo felt like a foreign noir film. Some dark, fascinating, catastrophe breeding space. On every flat surface was a scatteration of papers and documents. Along every wall were rows of boxes spilling over with videotapes and office equipment. In every corner were closed-stuff shopping bags emblazoned with a Street Fashions USA logo, which I recognized from the card he'd given me a week before. In one corner of his condo was a blue unicorn statue with a gold horn. Near it, he'd parked a shopping cart filled with empty plastic bags. In the opposite corner was a life-size mannequin that had been posed oddly, I guess you'd have to say. The thing sort of looked like it had been assaulted and left for dead. On the shelves were dozens of Dalmatian figurines and Disney toys. Every window was shrouded with red drapes, dyeing the little sunlight that managed to seep inside a hysterical horror film red. Tommy's hardwood floor was partly covered with zebra skins. From what I could see of the floor, a lot of it had been ruined. This condo had a long, complicated, archaeological history of mess behind it. Tommy showed me around, starting with the photos on the walls, many of which were of himself, including a few grand, framed, neoclassical portraits he'd had done. I didn't have to be a French speaker to diagnose the syndrome afflicting a man who decides to commission an oil painting of himself. Nouveau riche. He showed me his Skeletor death masks, his Pinocchio sculpture, his vases of crisply dead roses, his Julius Caesar bust with a sketch of Tommy directly next to it. Uh-oh. His African and Aztec objet d'art. his impressive collection of memorabilia that somehow featured the American flag, his pyramid diorama, his small Statue of Liberty shrine, and a framed poem entitled, "I Do Not Choose to Be a Common Man." On one cluttered desk, Tommy kept a picture of himself standing in front of the Eiffel Tower. It looked as though it had been taken in the 1960s. When Tommy noticed me looking at it, he said, "I almost got arrested because I tried to walk on the grass. French assholes." One thing he didn't show me, but which I noticed when I passed by it, was his framed degree from Laney College, a junior college in Oakland, where he'd made the honor roll. "What did you study at Laney?" I asked, turning to him. "I studied the psychology." We came to his bookshelf, crammed with a peculiar collection of books. How to Write a Letter, Wealth 101, Shower Power, Wet, Warm, and Wonderful Exercises for the Shower and Bath, The Pill Book, A Guide to the Most Prescribed Drugs in America, Foot Talk, 100 Ways to Reward Employees. One shelf was filled with books about acting, The Stanislavski Method, Brando, and James Dean. The year before, I had read Rebel, Donald Spoto's James Dean biography, which Tommy owned. He also owned another Dean biography I hadn't read, Joe Hyams' Little Boy Lost. "James Dean?" I said, picking up the Hyams book. "You must be kidding me," Tommy said. "You don't know James Dean?" I did, of course, but I allowed Tommy's misunderstanding of my question to hang there. "Well," Tommy said, "he's the best actor. You borrow this, you read about him, and it would all make sense." Like a million other male actors, I was fascinated by Dean. The aspect of Dean's life story that affected me most deeply was the lack of support shown to him by his father, who urged his son to pursue law. Spoto's book had made clear that a lot of Dean's legendary appeal was a result of his dying fast and young, with only 3 films under his belt. Still, Dean was compellingly raw in East of Eden, which remains one of my favorite film performances of all time. Maybe that was what I liked about Tommy, too. He went for it, however insanely. I wanted to drink some water before we started rehearsing, so Tommy took me into his kitchen. All the cupboards were open and his sink was filled with a pile of dirty dishes and cloudy water. Hanging from the ceiling were 2 long sticky fly traps, both prodigiously covered in fruit flies. I no longer wanted to drink anything. "How about some carrot juice?" Tommy asked. I checked the date on the bottle he gave me. "This expired 3 months ago," I said. "Well, excuse me," Tommy said. "The maid is on vacation." He put the carrot juice back into his fridge. On his refrigerator door, Tommy had an array of magnets he'd collected of iconic American tourist sites. Las Vegas, the Space Needle, the Grand Canyon, the Hollywood sign, Graceland. Just in case his patriotism was in any doubt, he'd arranged them around a larger magnet of the American flag. Magneted to the fridge door was an outdated headshot with Thomas P. Wiseau written underneath it. Below that was a picture of Tommy with what looked like his natural hair. It was shorter and chestnut brown. Sitting in a storefront window at what appeared to be Christmas time in a place that may have been New Orleans. In the photo, Tommy was looking off into the middle distance, past the camera. How clean and untroubled these young Tommy eyes were, especially compared to the eyes of the man standing next to me, and their spook house repository of secrets. "When was this taken?" I asked him. Tommy looked from the photo, to me, to the photo.
"A few years ago, when I was a little kid."
He looked at least 30 in this photo. "You look really young. Different."
"I'm not so old now, you know."
So, how old are you?
He smiled and shook his head. Okay, you rub it in now. Don't go to certain territory.
I leaned in for a closer look at the fridge door Tommy as the following thought passed coldly through me. Something really awful happened to the guy in this picture. In the living room, we started preparing for our rehearsal. Tommy told me he used to take acting classes in Los Angeles with a teacher named Vincent Chase. I hadn't heard of Vincent Chase at the time, but I would later. A lot of people would. Mark Wahlberg studied with him and named Adrien Grenier's character and entourage in his honor. Tommy referred to Chase as the Vince. I asked Tommy what kind of stuff he'd done with the Vince. Within seconds, he was pulling an old camcorder from a box and hooking it up to his television. "Watch," he said, and hit play. In the clip, I saw Tom Sizemore critiquing the class along with Vince. A much younger-looking Tommy was doing a scene with an actor I recognized. He and Tommy hadn't gotten very far into their scene when Vince began ripping both of their performances apart. "Hey," I said, "hasn't that guy been on Baywatch?"
"Yeah," Tommy said. "We were supposed to be roommates, but he find different place. I think he do gigolo stuff for money."
The footage bore aging videotape waveforms along the bottom of the screen, and both Tommy's and his scene partner's clothes had a Max Headroom mid-1980s vibe to them. "When was this class?" I asked.
Tommy turned the video off. "I'm sorry," he said, "but we don't ask about that. Don't be smart guy, okay?"
I dropped it. "So how was class?" I asked him, "when you weren't being shredded by the Vince." Tommy shrugged.
"It was okay. He's a good teacher. The Vince was tough, tough cookie. He'd kick your ass."
This wasn't Tommy's only LA class. He told me he's also taken a film class at Los Angeles Community College.
"So you lived in LA for a while?"
"No," he said. "Was like commute. I would fly to LA on Thursday for class and fly back home the same night."
I never heard anything so ridiculous. How did he afford that?
"I know, so crazy," Tommy said. "But I have to take class. I want to be a filmmaker. I make movie in class. I got A minus."
"You made a movie? What was it called?"
"Robbery Doesn't Pay," Tommy said proudly. "Tiny little thing, shot on the Super 8.
He showed me a couple of frames of the tiny little thing, which consisted of a large, hairy-looking guy in a white t-shirt casing an L.A. neighborhood for a car to steal, all of it scored to Orgy's cover of Blue Monday. Surprisingly, Tommy wasn't in the film.
"Enough for now," Tommy said. "Time to rehearse."
We ran through the scene a few times, after which I suggested we put the scripts away and go off book. Tommy was hesitant, but agreed. To give him a minute to prepare, I asked to use his restroom. There I found a professional makeup mirror and a pair of rusty 25-pound dumbbells on the floor next to the toilet. Above the toilet was a large frame poster of the Disney character Aladdin. Going off book turned out to be a bad idea. Tommy couldn't remember anything, not even lines made up of nothing more than yes or no.
When he couldn't remember his lines, he waved his hands around, shouted, made up new lines, or did all those things at once.
His mouth and mind had trouble establishing any lasting connection to each other. English was obviously not Tommy's first language, but I was beginning to wonder if it was even his third or fourth. When he wasn't being hysterical, he was critiquing my performance. "It has to be big," he kept saying. "It has to be powerful." Of course this guy loves Brando and Dean, I thought. They're captivating actors because they know exactly when to yell, when to floor it. Tommy believed you had to floor it for the duration of every scene. What on earth compelled this man to want to act? His money explained his condo, his Mercedes, his weekly acting class commutes to Los Angeles. but nothing I'd seen or heard so far explained him. I was no longer rehearsing a scene. I was private investigating another human being. "What's Street Fashions USA?" I asked him in the middle of our scene, motioning toward one of the shopping bags in the corner. Tommy looked over at the bag, suddenly uncomfortable.
"I do marketing, you know, retail stuff."
He stopped himself.
"My God, you are such a nosy person."
I found it hard to believe that this guy could do marketing for Fangoria magazine, much less fashion. The Street Fashions USA locations listed on the bag were Haight Street, Beach Street, and Sutter Street. But the bags were cheaply printed. The Levi's logo didn't appear to have its standard trademark look. "You don't seem like a retail guy to me," I said. Tommy took this with a good-humored shrug.
"You don't know me yet. I have many skills."
"So why acting?" Tommy's hands retreated into his pockets, and I sensed him fight some small, quick battle over how much to tell me.
"Well, you see, since I was a little kid, it's always been my big dream to be actor, for a long time. I tried Los Angeles, etc., but it didn't come out right. Then I have business here, so I stopped the acting. But then, to make long story short, I had an accident. I was driving, I got hit by the guy who runs the red light."
He'd said this so quietly and soberly that I didn't dare say anything.
"It was pretty bad," he went on. "Like wake-up call, you could say. I was in hospital for many weeks. After that, I decided to go back to my acting dream."
He picked up his playbook, and we continued rehearsing. After a few read-throughs, Tommy asked if I wanted to grab dinner. I suggested a Chinese place called Hunan on Sansom Street. While waiting for our food, Tommy once again began to tell me that I could succeed as an actor if I wanted it enough.
"You can be star, but you have to be more powerful. When you are aggressive in scene, this is worth $1 million.
"What about you?" I asked, not trusting the thickness of what he was laying on me. Tommy didn't answer that question. Instead, he started playing with his chopsticks, which he'd learned to use, he said, when he was living in Hong Kong. But I brought him back to the question. "What about you, Tommy? Tell me." Tommy set his chopsticks aside.
"For me," he said, "I always wanted to have my own planet. Call it Tommy's Planet. Build a giant building there, you see, like Empire Tower, some casino thing. My planet will be bigger than everything."
I found myself unexpectedly charmed by this burst of subdued bravado. It wasn't obnoxious. It was sort of endearing. I felt like I'd just asked a child what he wanted to be when he grew up. And a child had answered me, honestly, with no adult filter telling him what was and wasn't possible. "Your own planet?" I said. I wanted to laugh, but I couldn't. In fact, I had goosebumps. This man sitting in front of me had no detectable talent, did everything wrong, wasn't comfortable saying how old he was or where he was from, and seemed to take an hour to learn what most people picked up in 5 seconds. Still, for that moment, I believed him. I believed he could have his own planet.
"Yeah," he said, looking up. "I see this big thing and big light, a big events with stores and hotel and movie. All these things all together. It would be spectacular."
He reached for his glass of hot water, but hesitated before lifting it to his mouth. Tommy peered at me from beneath his large, protruding brow.
"And you can live in my planet if you decide. Maybe I let you stay for a little while."
What did I think of living on Tommy's planet? I wasn't sure. What I was sure of was that Tommy had something I'd never seen in anyone else. a blind and unhinged and totally unfounded ambition. He was so out of touch, so lacking in self-awareness, yet also weirdly captivating. That night there was this aura around Tommy, an aura of the possible. Stick with him, I thought, and something would happen, even if I had no idea what that something might be. Maybe that was it. Tommy made me listen to the right voices in my head. This big, childish vision of his, what was it, if not every actor's secret dream? My own planet was increasingly icy and lonely and minor, and while I did not rule out the possibility that Tommy's planet was a civilization-ending comet headed my way, what if it wasn't? Here, Tommy said, I have a present for you. He handed me a red, white, and blue pen, the casing of which bore the Street Fashions USA logo. He gave it to me as though it were a sacred scepter, as though I'd passed some test. When I looked more closely at the pen, I saw something else. A tiny globe with the words Tommy's Planet printed across it.
5. People are very strange these days. You don't yell at a sleepwalker. He may fall and break his neck. Joe Gillis, Sunset Boulevard. Sandy walked over to Kyle, Tommy, and me with an alarmed look on his face. Tommy, he said, what the hell's going on? I just learned we haven't been rolling film on Dawn. Tommy was looking down, his eyes hidden by his white Gilligan sun hat. He said nothing. Sandy sighed. Tommy, make a decision. If you want Greg in this picture, do the decent thing and let the other kid go. Tommy crossed his arms, but again said nothing. Is it a talent thing? Sandy asked, still assuming that Tommy worked off a comprehensible decision-making matrix. Are you doing this to watch both of them on tape and see who you like better? Is this some sort of post-casting tryout? Tommy, no response. Sandy was getting desperate now. Jesus, Tommy, pick one! Tommy grew visibly uncomfortable when Sandy raised his voice. He was all for creating drama, typically, but only drama that he could control. I want this guy out, Tommy said, looking up at Sandy. We stick with Greg at this time. And I want what's-her-name, blondie girl, Michelle? She's gone, too. Tommy had been rehearsing with Brianna for weeks. But, like Don, who was really Dan, he still didn't know her name. Sandy stared at Tommy in disbelief. Tommy, we don't have another Michelle. And we've already shot those alley scenes inside with Brianna. Don't worry, Tommy said. We get another one. The cast and crew, though they couldn't hear Tommy and Sandy, were all carefully monitoring their conversation. Tommy pulled me aside, lowered his voice even more, and said, stay quiet. We don't want legal issue. With that, he headed straight for Don and Brianna, who were standing at the other side of the lot. Don started shaking his head. What is this about, Tommy? He asked. Don't worry, Tommy said, stopping. We pay you. Come back tomorrow, I give you check. Don, Greg's not even an actor. Tommy, this is what producers want. Then he looked at Brianna and, with a lazy hand flip, said, you have to leave also. I'm sorry, but the producers don't want you in the movie at this time. Come back tomorrow and we pay you check. As Tommy walked back toward the rest of us, Kyle said, Tommy, I hope you're aware that Greg doesn't have a contract. And he can't film until he has one. Tommy glanced over at Kyle. Please mind your own business, smart guy. This is not your issue. You want to be actor? Act like one. Kyle bit his tongue, put his hands up, and went off, I think, to go scream a bit before filming his and my next few scenes on the rooftop set, which still wasn't completely built. After a few takes, a frustrated Tommy announced that we'd resume filming the next morning. When Tommy left the set that night, he insisted on bringing his HD camera home with him. When I asked why, Tommy said, "Thieves." By the time I delivered Tommy to the set the next day, the crew had completed construction of the rooftop. The lighting was all set up and the dolly tracks were laid. Breakfast had already been eaten. Several games of chess had been played atop the bed of Sandy's pickup truck, and multiple cigarette breaks had been savored. Tommy, as always, had demanded that everyone, cast, crew, everyone, arrive on set at 8 a.m. He graced the set with his presence a little after noon, just as half the cast and crew were beginning lunch. The one person who figured out Tommy's modus operandi early on was Amy, the makeup artist, who after the second day of production started showing up 3 hours late and was never once busted for it. Tommy was sporting his white Gilligan hat, red-lensed Oakleys, a black tank top, and sand-colored cargo pants. He was, I knew from the car ride over, a man with a mission today. Tommy was carrying several dozen 8x10 printouts, which he began papering all over the set. These printouts read, "Actors do not interact with crew." The words had been rendered in 3 different colors, 4 different fonts, and 5 different type sizes. Then Tommy began to set up little postcard piles in high traffic areas around the set. These read, "The room, the play, the movie, the drama, it's coming." Finally, Tommy handed out business cards to every member of the cast and crew. Some said, "Tommy Wiseau, the actor." Others said, "Tommy Wiseau, the director." Others said, "Tommy Wiseau, the producer." And one said, "He can do your project, or be part of it, well with passion and dedication." The last was generally accepted among the room's cast and crew as the most extraordinary document anyone had ever seen. While everyone marveled at Tommy's chutzpah, the man himself sat down and started doing curls with rusted dumbbells. In the last few months, he'd gotten extremely and upsettingly ripped, and now looked like a man who'd spent several months starving to death on a desert island with a solo flex as his only company. I took a look at the finished rooftop set, which seemed funny surrounded by parked cars. Almost everyone involved with the room had asked Tommy why he was building a fake rooftop in the middle of a studio's parking lot rather than filming on a real rooftop or, I don't know, using the actual studio space whose parking lot he was filming in. Tommy brushed all these questions away with the mistaken postulation that we do no different than big studio. Filming the room's rooftop scenes in the parking lot of Burns and Sawyer created many problems, the most persistent being light. Due to Tommy's lateness, he almost always missed out on filming in mellow morning light. From noon to 5 p.m., when Tommy liked to film, you get a wide range of light conditions, most of which are hostile to camera lenses. This should explain why, in the finished film, the rooftop scenes all look like they're taking place in different climates and countries, depending on the angle in the shot. Shooting outside made every rooftop scene a protracted battle against fading and changing light, necessitating the constant, busy draping of the rooftop with blockers, curtains, and gauzy white screens during the day, and, after sunset, illuminating the rooftop with a battery of supernovally intense lights, making it look like a little fluorescent igloo. The makeup chair was Tommy's favorite place to learn his lines, and he always insisted I stay near him when he was running them. Between sips of Red Bull, Tommy recited the first line of the first scene he wanted to shoot that day. "Oh, hi, Mark." He did the line with different spins and emphases. "Oh, hi, Mark. Oh, hi, Mark. Oh, hi, Mark."
Oh, hi, Mark.
Until he was sure he had it. Amy, the makeup artist, was working on Tommy throughout this process, dabbing at his face while he gestured. Tommy, satisfied with his "Oh, hi, Mark" delivery, moved on to a moment later in the scene, which involved Johnny and Denny. He read the line woodenly.
You can love someone deep inside your heart. There's nothing wrong with it.
Then he turned to me and asked,
How is my voice today? I know I do something wrong. I'm losing my mind. Can you correct me?
You're doing fine, I assured him. Sandy wandered over to find out what Tommy wanted to shoot first.
We are shooting roof scene with Johnny and Mark, Tommy said. Don't worry, we're ready in 5 minutes.
Sandy lumbered off, certain that Tommy's 5 minutes meant more like an hour and a half. The room's costume designer, Safua, had ducked out for a moment to run some wardrobe errands because Tommy was so late. Of course, the moment Tommy learned that Safua was no longer around, he decided he was ready to get dressed for his scene. He began to panic.
We need her now, not tomorrow, he said. I don't hire her not to be here. I'm not doing her job.
Amy told Tommy that Safua would be back any second, but Tommy, unsatisfied, headed directly to wardrobe and dressed himself. He probably could not have picked a worse outfit had he been blindfolded. An ill-fitting navy blue sport coat over his favorite black tank top and sand-colored cargo pants, the pockets of which were stuffed with lotion bottles, anti-wrinkling gel, purple scrunchies, hair clips, and cash. He looked like an aging metrosexual commando. Safua returned from her errand, took one look at Tommy, and nearly fainted. I believe the word she used to describe his outfit was unfilmable. Tommy, of course, refused to change.
I keep my stuff, sweetie. You are late. Please don't do this again.
Tommy, Safua said, you can't just pick things off the rack at random and start shooting. Sensing she wasn't going to win this argument, she turned to grab her camera. I need to get a Polaroid of your outfit for continuity.
Continuity, Tommy said, stopping her, is in your forehead.
Would you at least empty your pocket, Safua asked. Can we agree to that?
I cannot, Tommy said.
Safua briefly looked like she was about to punch him. Tommy, noticing this, put his hand on her shoulder.
You are very sweet, and I push you a little bit, but don't hate me yet.
From Safua's expression, it was clear that Tommy's request was several seconds too late. The scene Tommy wanted to shoot was my first with him that didn't involve other cast members. We started with the master shots of the conversation Johnny and Mark have after Johnny spontaneously storms onto the rooftop, denying that he's hit his future wife, Lisa. The ensuing conversation concerns women, mostly, and the possibility that they are evil. When Johnny tells Mark that Lisa is loyal to him, remember, Mark is banging Lisa pretty regularly by this point in the film, Mark says, "Yeah, man, you never know. People are very strange these days," which is one of the most majestically odd lines in the whole film. Mark then tells Johnny a story about a woman friend of his who enjoyed the company of a dozen guys. Unfortunately, one of these surly gentlemen discovered his lover's promiscuity. He beat her up so bad, Mark tells Johnny, she ended up in a hospital. To which Johnny responds,
"What a story, Mark!"
For reasons neither I nor anyone else could gather, every time I got to the part in Mark's story about the woman being beaten up, Tommy would laugh warmly before delivering his line. It was unsettling. It was disturbing. Take after take, Tommy, Johnny, would react to the story of this imaginary woman's hospitalization with fond and accepting laughter. After a few takes, Sandy took Tommy aside and, as though speaking to a child, told him that this beaten-up woman business was not funny, not at all. It was, in fact, a very sad line, and maybe Tommy should shoot for a response that was more, shall we say, emotionally involved. Sandy went so far as to demonstrate for Tommy what Johnny's concerned body language should look like. It was as though Tommy had never bothered to contemplate what the line he wrote actually meant. Tommy laughed again during the next take. Sandy stepped away from his monitor, looked at the ground, and said, "Okay, not funny, Tommy. No laugh there. Remember, be concerned." Sandy's eyes were bleak with false enthusiasm, and his voice sounded like a cable getting ready to snap. We'd been shooting this idiotic conversation for more than an hour. Tommy and I did the exchange again. This time, Tommy didn't laugh. Instead, he said his line, "What a story, Mark," with absolutely no emotion at all. This effect was improbably even weirder than the takes he had laughed in. Sandy gave up and we moved on. Then it was time to do the coverage shots of our individual close-ups. In an attempt to loosen Tommy up a bit, I changed the line that had been provoking his laughter. Instead of, "He beat her up so bad, she ended up in a hospital," I ad-libbed, "He beat her up so bad, she ended up in a hospital on Guerrero Street." Of course, there is no hospital on Guerrero Street, but Tommy's San Francisco condo was located there. I knew full well that anything having to do with Tommy's personal life was a matter of national security, but the reference was so obscure that I couldn't imagine him being worried about it. No one involved in the room even knew that Tommy had lived in San Francisco, let alone that he had a condo there. This was going to be a ridiculous scene no matter what, and I guess I was trying to remind Tommy to approach it more playfully. Attempting to mine Tommy's scenes for authentic or plausible emotion was never going to work. You couldn't make these scenes realistic, I figured, so why not have fun? Tommy laughed again, more ghoulishly than before. When the camera stopped, Tommy dragooned me into a quiet place, away from the crew. "Are you insane completely?" he said. His eyes were all dancing panic. "You must be crazy in the head. Now we can erase this information from 35mm film." I tried to calm him down. "Tommy, it's a street name. Nobody knows what I was referring to." Tommy gave me a hard, cold look. "I'm not happy about your statement." He was even less happy when the only usable audio from all the coverage happened to be in the take where I ad-libbed the Guerrero Street line, which was why it wound up in the room at all. We filmed the first part of Tommy's and my scene, Johnny making his dramatic entrance onto the rooftop, last. To shoot him doing this, the crew had to rearrange the rooftop walls and push into place the tiny, tin-roofed outhouse that was doubling as the rooftop's access door. Since the outhouse was so small, there was no room inside to create the illusion of continued movement. This meant that anyone being filmed exiting it had to stand perfectly still while waiting until action was called. Coming out of that thing, you stumbled into your scene. In the original draft of the room script, the stage direction reads, "Johnny opens the door to the roof access. Mark is sitting there." Tommy had decided this wasn't dramatic or emotional enough, especially now that he'd rewritten his script to include scenes in which Lisa claims to others that Johnny has abused her. To establish that Johnny is incapable of abuse, Tommy concocted a new opening for this scene, in which Johnny steps onto the rooftop saying, "It's not true, I did not hit her, it's bullshit, I did not." After which comes this, "Oh, hi, Mark." There are 17 words in this sequence. 11 of them are non-recurring. Only one carries the burden of a second syllable. In other words, these are not terribly difficult lines to learn. Sandy had blocked the scene so that Tommy would emerge from the outhouse, hit his mark on the second "I did not," look up, nail his eyeline, say, "Oh, hi, Mark," and walk off camera to where we, the audience, imagine Mark to be sitting. Most school plays contain scenes that pose bigger technical acting challenges. Tommy couldn't remember his lines. He couldn't hit his mark. He couldn't say Mark. He couldn't walk, he couldn't find his eyeline. He would emerge from the outhouse mumbling, lost, and disoriented. He looked directly into the camera. He swore,